in prison for having organized the IWW. I just want to say I find, shockingly, the film is more relevant now than it was when we released it in 79.
And it's being put into the Library of Congress's National Film Registry, which is incredible, soon to be available to everyone, opening on May Day, which is Sunday. That does it for today's show. Deborah Schaefer, I want to thank you for being with us, co-director with Stuart Bird of the 1979 documentary The Wobblies that's just being released once again. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Happy May Day, everyone. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours. It will be ours. Oh, one day, when the war is won, we will be sure.
This is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Radio is celebrating Jazz Appreciation Month all of April. So support KBOO and commemorate America's greatest cultural export by getting your very own limited edition KBOO Jazz Appreciation Month t-shirt. Buy yours right now at kboo.fm/jamshirt.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor Portland Folk Music Society concerts. The series continues on Saturday, May 21st, with a trio of Latina singer-songwriters, Tish Hinojosa, Stephanie Urbina-Jones, and Patricia Vaughn, the Texicana Mamas. The Mamas use music and emotion to express their bicultural life experiences and strong pride in their Mexican-American heritage. The Portland Folk Music Series in Southeast Portland continues through June. For information, go to kboo.fm and click on Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this spring membership Hive Drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, High Crash Corridor 82nd Avenue has new hope for improvement as control is transferred to PBOT. Oregon and Washington officials will hold first vote on the new interstate bridge replacement project next week. And in national news, the U.S. economy shrunk for the first time since the start of the pandemic. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, April 29th, 2022. We'd like to remind you that you can become a member and support our programming at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give or texting KBOO to 44321. I'm Josh Salem. Ownership and responsibility for 82nd Avenue in Portland has officially been transferred to the city, away from state control, as of Thursday. It's a move that transportation safety advocates have been pushing for a long time. 82nd is a so-called orphan highway. It's actually Oregon State Route 213, and it's one of the most dangerous roads for cars and pedestrians in the city. 19 people were killed on that street in the past 15 years, most of them pedestrians. The danger is most frequently chalked up to the failure of ODOT to invest in the road. Now, it's under the control of the Portland Bureau of Transportation, or PBOT. PBOT plans to spend $80 million in safety improvements on the road, with funds from the American Rescue Plan Act. Both the state and city have promised more eventual funding for the project as well. The stretch of the road that will get improvements is 7 miles long, from northeast Killingsworth to southeast Clatsop. The planned improvements include filling the gaps in streetlights along the corridor, adding 18 new pedestrian crossings, and ADA accessible curb ramps. They also intend to add technology and safety improvements intended to slow down speeding drivers. City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty oversees the Portland Bureau of Transportation. She said in a statement, quote, "This historic day would not have happened without the dedicated, passionate advocacy of community members who demanded for years that their government do more to make our streets safer. It will take many years to fix this street and many years to achieve the community's vision. But if we continue to work together, we will get there." End quote. Transportation officials and legislators in Oregon and Washington will have their first opportunity to vote on the early plans to replace the interstate bridge next week. The steering committee will vote on May 5th on the new bridge design between Oregon and Washington. The current design includes light rail transit and extra lanes. Light rail transit, rather than rapid bus lanes, is a point of contention because light rail was the sticking point that tanked the last proposal to replace the bridge in 2014. The extra lanes are also a concern, especially for environmental activists. The interstate bridge is narrow for how important it is, and there are several interchanges right around the area that require drivers to make quick decisions. The new plan hopes to mitigate and combine some of these to improve traffic. If the steering committee gives its approval next week, the project planners will spend the next 2 months going to 9 other governments and agencies for their approval. If they get those approvals, then the project would head to an extensive and federally mandated environmental review. Some aspects have not been decided yet, like how many new lanes will be added and how access to Hayden Island will change. As the bridge now stands, Hayden Island is only accessible through the I-5 interchange. The northbound span of the interstate bridge is over 100 years old and was built on unstable foundation. Experts say it is unlikely that it could survive the big one, the Cascadia subduction zone earthquake that hangs over our region's future. In the time between the previous plan's failure and this new round of planning, the estimated cost of the bridge replacement has gone up millions of dollars. The committee votes May 5th. Progressive groups in Washington state are pushing for a wealth tax to address income inequality. They say their state's tax code is the most regressive in the country, meaning the burden of taxes actually decreases with greater income. Eric Tegetoff has the story.
While the pandemic has fueled soaring profits for the country's richest, it's also exposed growing income inequality in the United States. Progressive groups are optimistic Washington state could tackle this through its tax code. Legislation that would impose a wealth tax didn't pass in Olympia this year, but likely will be back in 2023. Carolyn Brotherton with the Economic Opportunity Institute says the state has the most regressive tax system in the country.
The state wealth tax is one way that we can start addressing this inequality and put resources back into the communities that need it the most, rather than letting this wealth just grow and grow and grow into the hands of the very few at the very top of the wealth distribution.
Opponents of the wealth tax say it's essentially a graduated income tax, which is unconstitutional in Washington state. However, Brotherton doesn't believe that's the case. The legislation presented this year would exempt everyone with less than $1 billion in assets. Brotherton says, in essence, it would bring uniformity to the tax code.
The ultra-wealthy who grow their wealth by owning things like stocks and bonds will pay a 1% property tax on the privilege of owning that property, similar to how homeowners currently pay a 1% property tax on the privilege of owning real property in our state.
The State Department of Revenue estimates the tax would affect fewer than 100 people in Washington state. A fiscal analysis found it would raise about $2.5 billion a year. There have been other recent attempts to change taxes in Washington. In 2021, lawmakers passed a 7% capital gains tax on the sale of stocks, bonds, or other assets worth more than $250,000. It's been challenged in court, and signatures are being collected for a measure that would repeal the tax in November if voters approve. Brotherton says this would hurt communities, noting Washington's unfair tax code means more than numbers on paper.
What it means is that we have austerity baked into our system so that we're not fully funding the things that we know our communities need, such as K-12 education, such as climate resilience, such as housing, such as public health, and so on and so forth.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The U.S. economy shrank in the first 3 months of the year, and experts remain worried about higher inflation and rising interest rates. This was the first quarterly decline in gross domestic product since the pandemic hit in 2020. It represents a 1.4% drop on an annualized basis. Two trends led to the decline last quarter, according to a report yesterday from the Commerce Department. First, imports rose nearly 20%, while exports fell almost 6% as growth slowed overseas. This widened the trade deficit significantly. The second trend was that businesses built up inventories aggressively ahead of last year's holiday shopping season because they feared pandemic-related supply shortages. Then they restocked more slowly at the start of 2022. As a result, the nation's total output of goods and services fell far below the about 7% annual growth rate from the fourth quarter of 2021. The good news is, economists predict a return to growth for the rest of 2022, based on a strong job market and robust consumer spending. They do not think the U.S. faces a recession. Also, the Federal Reserve plans to raise interest rates to fight inflation. The job market, which some believe is the most important supporter of the economy, remains very strong, with the unemployment rate near a 50-year low and wages rising steadily. And in the January to March quarter, businesses and consumers increased their spending at a rate of about 4% more than the usual annual rate after adjusting for inflation. Economists consider these trends a better gauge of the economy's core strength than the latest goods and services figures. Still, serious threats have emerged. Supply chain disruptions in China and other countries continue because of the pandemic, and the war in Ukraine is contributing to higher inflation. Last month, prices in Ukraine rose nearly 9% from a year earlier, the fastest rise in 40 years. The first quarter's weak performance contrasts with last year's robust rebound from the pandemic, which was fueled in part by heavy government aid and ultra-low interest rates. Stimulus checks and other government supports have ended, contributing to slowing consumer spending. Previously, President Biden pointed to rapid growth as a counterpoint to soaring inflation. Last quarter's negative GDP number also undercuts that key political message. Biden and Democrats, who face midterm elections this year, fear rising prices for food, energy, and other essentials will be a major theme of Republican opposition. The global economy is expected to grow more slowly this year, according to the International Monetary Fund. It predicts the Ukraine war and COVID will slow global growth to half what it was last year. Meanwhile, a poll commissioned by Oregon Public Radio shows nearly two-thirds of voters rate Oregon's economic conditions as poor or very poor. Nearly as many said they expect things to get worse. Numbers seem related to political affiliation. Republicans were more likely to report the economy was in bad shape than Democrats. Even so, almost half of Democrats surveyed said the economy is lagging. Economists are less pessimistic. They feel after steep drops at the outset of the pandemic, many key indicators of the state economy are coming back briskly. Christian Kaler, an economist with the Oregon Employment Department, said, quote, "In our lifetimes, in our parents' lifetimes, we never saw an economy as bad as 2020. And the good news is, in our lifetimes, we've never seen an economy as good as 2021, end quote. The state's unemployment rate is at 3.8%, far better than the 13.3% rate observed in April of 2020. It's not much different than the unemployment level Oregon had before the pandemic. The Portland region, which accounts for more than half of the state's economy, outperformed most large metros in jobs added. Economists now predict the state's economy will make a full recovery by the end of this year. And at the end of that recovery, wages for many Oregonians will be much higher than they were at the pandemic's outset. Even so, the fact many Oregonians have significant discretionary money, especially in light of supply chain problems, has helped lead to a nearly 8% increase in prices over the last year, the biggest jump in four decades. Price increases brought on by inflation have begun to outstrip higher wages, meaning the average worker effectively took a pay cut last year, despite making more. And a tight housing market has led to higher rents and bidding wars for limited homes on the market. Economic conditions may affect how people vote. More than 60% of voters in the survey said the cost of living in the state is a very serious issue. While even the governor has limited power to affect inflation or create jobs, the state's chief elected official and legislature can adjust taxes and business regulation. A number of this year's gubernatorial candidates have based a significant part of their platforms on how Governor Brown has handled COVID. For example, Republican candidates for governor have panned a new business tax that resulted in billions of dollars more for public schools, arguing it reduces the ability of Oregon businesses to compete. Josh Lerner is an economist with the Oregon Office of Economic Analysis. Lerner said, quote, "The standard economic data look pretty darn good, aside from inflation. The outlook is bright. Already, the region is caught up economically to other large metro areas, despite local social challenges and public perception. However, The key question is whether or not Portland will reclaim its perch among the highest flyers around the country, which remains to be seen. End quote. You're listening to a spring membership Hive Drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sona Lee. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather. We expect rain showers with a low of 53 degrees. Tomorrow, that rain continues with a high of 55. Today in history, in 1970, tennis great Andre Agassi was born. He was formerly first in the world in tennis, won 8 majors, and was an Olympic gold medalist. The quote of the day is from Agassi, who said, "What makes something special is not just what you have to gain, but what you feel there is to lose." President Biden requests $33 billion for military and humanitarian aid in Ukraine, and the administration creates a disinformation bureau. With those stories and more, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We either back Ukrainian people as they defend their country, or we stand by as the Russians continue their atrocities and aggression in Ukraine.
President Biden has requested $33 billion from Congress for military and humanitarian aid to Ukraine and called for additional funding to help America's COVID-19 pandemic response. Free speech advocates are criticizing the administration's newly created disinformation bureau under the Department of Homeland Security. Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
It sounds like the objective of the board is to prevent disinformation and misinformation from traveling around the country in a range of communities. I'm not sure who opposes that effort.
On Thursday, the U.S. and 60 global partners launched the Declaration for the Future of the Internet, which calls for a framework to support a free and open Internet, with goals including affordability, net neutrality, promoting free expression, and removing illegal content. Democrats say they are working on legislation to lower gas prices and beef up government power to address alleged price gouging. Nancy Pelosi on big oil companies profiteering and exploiting the marketplace.
They are hoarding the windfall while keeping prices high.
Georgia Republican Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene is promoting her 21st Century Free Speech Act, which would abolish the law protecting online platforms from liability.
Social media is important to our democracy. So just like any other vital industry, such as energy or finance, we must have rules ensuring that private corporations don't do things that hurt Americans.
Canadian Defense Minister Anita Anand held a joint news conference with Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, where they reaffirmed the two countries' shared goals in support of Ukraine against Russian aggression.
Since day one of this attack, our Ukrainian friends have faced Putin's forces with unfailing courage and resolve. And Canada, like the United States, stands firmly with them.
Lawmakers in Canada's House of Commons this week unanimously adopted a motion to recognize Russia is committing acts of genocide against the Ukrainian people. The FDA has proposed a ban on all menthol cigarettes and flavored cigars. Supporters argue it would improve the health of Black Americans, who are more likely to smoke menthol products. Finally, former President Donald Trump has thrown his support behind Clark County Sheriff Joe Lombardo in his race for governor of Nevada. Lombardo is vying for the right to challenge Democratic Governor Steve Sisolak. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The state of New York is home to about 40,000 Holocaust survivors, and this week, the governor announced millions in new funding for medical, legal, and financial support for survivors. Jonah Chester has more.
New York Governor Kathy Hochul has announced the state will be allocating about $2.6 million to increase financial and medical support for survivors of the Holocaust, the genocide of European Jews during World War II. According to the governor's office, about 40% of New York State's nearly 40,000 Holocaust survivors live in poverty. At a news conference announcing the funding, Hochul said the money would be distributed to nearly 30 organizations who will provide social services to survivors.
We are here to recommit ourselves to supporting the survivors. And it is our duty, not just as New Yorkers, but as citizens of the world. And it's something I take very seriously.
Hochul says the youngest survivors of the Holocaust now are in their mid-70s and will likely require more support and financial aid as they continue to age. The funding, which is carved from the state's 2023 fiscal year budget, will go towards case management, mental health services, emergency financial assistance, and legal services, among other things. The new funding comes as New York sees an uptick in anti-Semitic hate speech and violence. The Anti-Defamation League documented 416 anti-Semitic incidents across the state in 2021, the highest number since the organization began tracking such data. Holocaust survivor Eva Gann says ethics and history lessons for young kids can be a major tool in rooting out anti-Semitism early on.
This is America. This is a free country, and we have to protect that freedom. When freedom is denied, then chaos comes in.
The ADL last year documented more than 2,700 anti-Semitic incidents nationally, which included assaults, harassments, and vandalism. That's also the highest number of incidents since the organization started tracking in 1979. Hochul says the security funding in her budget will help prevent future assaults and violent incidents. For the New York News Connection, I'm Jonah Chester.
The Mississippi River was named in a recent report highlighting endangered waterways, thrusting it into the spotlight. Conservation advocates are looking at ways to get the river off the list, including the need for specific federal action. Mike Mohn has more on the story.
The Great Lakes, the Puget Sound, and other notable watersheds are afforded massive federal support to coordinate and fund pollution reduction efforts. But the Mississippi River isn't, and clean water advocates say a troubling report should spur action. The Mississippi River, which flows along 10 states, including Iowa, recently landed on American River's 10 Most Endangered Rivers list for 2022. The group's Olivia Dorothy says this well-known river is at a crossroads. Despite existing programs and volunteer efforts to shield it from pollution, such as agriculture runoff, she says the patchwork approach isn't enough.
They're not all marching to the beat of the same drum. And so what we hope and what we've seen the EPA do in other watersheds, the EPA does a really, really great job getting everybody working in lockstep.
Congress is being asked to approve the Mississippi River Restoration and Resilience Initiative. It would provide around $300 million annually to aid a more coordinated response. Some skeptics have floated concerns about adding regulations, but supporters say it doesn't come with mandates and would not take over existing restoration programs. Alicia Vasto of the Iowa Environmental Council says threats like farm fertilizer pollution not only affect communities along the Mississippi River, but other regions as well because of the numerous tributaries around the state.
Anything that we do to protect the Mississippi River is also going to protect our local waterways and improve things for Iowans.
And those nutrients also flow down the Mississippi to the so-called dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. At the state level, Vasto says the report should prompt policymakers to enhance Iowa's nutrient reduction strategy. The council says that should include mandatory participation among farmers, so long as it's tailored to meet the size of each producer's operation. Mike Mohn, Iowa News Service.
The governor of Maine says a local tribe needs to stop its push for greater sovereignty rights on their land or risk souring relations with her administration. With that story and more, it's Shirley Jihad with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Shirley Jihad, in for Antonia Gonzalez. Maine Governor Janet Mills is asking Passamaquoddy tribe representatives to drop their push for expanded sovereignty powers. Her request comes after efforts in the legislature failed to reverse a state law that restricts sovereignty. Mills says continuing the sovereignty push could be a setback in tribal relations with her administration. The issue relates to the tribe's efforts to drill new wells on tribal land for clean water to replace an unsatisfactory water supply. The state law requires the tribe to secure approval from the state
which so far has not been granted. In Utah, the U.S. Federal Appeals Court says a tribal court ruling has no jurisdiction in a water dispute involving a non-tribal member. As the Salt Lake Tribune reports, the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals ruled the Ute Tribes Court overstepped its bounds when it ordered a stop to the irrigation water to a rancher's operation that includes tribal land. The appeals court says the tribal court has no authority over non-tribal members. It also affirms a previous decision that the tribal court's jurisdiction applies only to cases that affect the tribe's political integrity, economic security, or health or welfare. The tribe maintains the water is reserved for tribal members under an agreement dating back to the reservation's founding in 1861. So far, Fairbanks city elected officials remain opposed to reading a native land acknowledgement at the start of city council meetings. The city council rejected a resolution to do that in March. Now native leaders are asking them to reconsider, saying it's a matter of history and a matter of respect. Dan Bross from KUAC reports.
Speaking during the public comment portion of a council meeting Monday, several local native leaders expressed disappointment with council members Jim Clark, Jerry Cleworth, Lonnie Marnie, and Aaron Gibson voting against the land acknowledgement resolution last month. Fairbanks Native Association Executive Director Steve Guinness recounted Clark's response to a letter from Native organizations about the land acknowledgement.
He stated that there are many cultures contributing to the community, and singling out would divide rather than unite us. Councilman Clark's response was the most honest one we received, and one which we wholeheartedly disagree with.
Member Jim Clark said he remains opposed to the required reading of a land acknowledgement at council meetings.
If a city singles out an acknowledgement, it's also excluding others. And so for that reason, I'm just against any type of acknowledgement. And I think we can just agree to disagree on that. But it doesn't diminish any type of respect.
Member Jerry Cleworth repeated his position that a land acknowledgement is better displayed in the council chambers, along with the Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights, and other historical documents.
That's Dan Bross reporting from KUAC Radio. Dartmouth College has returned a collection of historic 200-year-old handwritten papers back to the Mohegan tribe. Dartmouth officials returned the papers in a repatriation ceremony. The papers were written in the 18th century by Samson Occam, a scholar and member of the Mohegan tribe. The collection includes letters, diaries, sermons, and a page of indigenous herbal remedies. Occam wrote in five languages, English, Greek, Latin, Hebrew, and Mohegan. Dartmouth experts say the papers contain what is believed to be the earliest example of written Mohegan language. With National Native News, I'm Shirley Jihad.
A new book says indigenous knowledge is key to fighting climate change. Jessica Hernandez is the author of Fresh Banana Leaves. She says indigenous communities are already taking steps to heal the environment. Dr. Anthony Lizowicz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowicz, and this is Climate Connections. Indigenous communities around the world have long managed forests, fisheries, and farmland. But Jessica Hernandez, a postdoctoral research fellow at the University of Washington, Bothell, says indigenous knowledge is sometimes disregarded in academic circles.
As an indigenous scientist, an indigenous woman studying environmental sciences, I often didn't see indigenous knowledges validated as a form of science.
Hernandez was raised in L.A. by parents from indigenous communities in Mexico and El Salvador.
The way that we pass down our knowledge is through storytelling, through oral traditions. It's not through written records that have undergone the peer review process.
In her recent book, Fresh Banana Leaves, Hernandez argues for applying indigenous knowledge to the climate crisis and other environmental issues. She says many indigenous communities are on the front lines of climate change.
Our indigenous communities are actually taking steps to mitigate the impacts of climate change. And that's, you know, a lot through protection of our environments, through the healing of our environments.
So she argues that blending indigenous perspectives with Western science can help produce more effective, holistic solutions. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to a spring membership Hive Drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Friday, April 29th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes myself, Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Shirley Jihad, Nadia Ramlagan, Jonah Chester, Eric Tegetoff, Mike Moen, and Anthony Lizowitz. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available at our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. We are in KBOO's Spring Membership Hive Drive, and now is a great time to help us out. If you'd like to become a member and support your local community radio station, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin.